On this week's 51%, we hear about a family divided between the U.S. and Italy during COVID-19.
You know, why would my, 80-year-old great aunt ever have the need to learn how to use Zoom? But here we are, and she's on there singing now.
And a woman talks about turning from her career in the pharmaceutical industry to a farm. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Volare. I know this woman with relatives in Italy. She's the communications director for a New York State senator in the Hudson Valley. It's an area I cover wearing my Hudson Valley News Bureau chief hat. And when she and I were setting up a time I could speak with the senator in March, she mentioned how she was spending time video chatting and singing with her relatives and how scary it was over in Italy. And U.S. beware. Jessica Galata says the majority of her mother's family, or several dozen relatives, live in Italy. She grew up spending her summers in Italy, and since she spent a few weeks there each year, at minimum. I spoke with Galata about her communication with family in Italy, and she starts by describing that communication before the COVID-19 crisis escalated.
Prior to this, we have like a WhatsApp group chat that everyone's kind of always chiming in at every given moment. I'll have a check-in with, the cousins that I'm closest to every couple weeks via FaceTime. But we have a group chat that's kind of ongoing at all times.
So you're in pretty much constant communication with your family in Italy, it sounds safe to say.
Yeah.
Given mm-hmm. where you are and jobs and all of that. So,
yep.
Take us back. When do things start to go kind of awry and you get really worried?
So I was actually just before we got on the phone, I was looking through my texts with one of my cousins, and it was end of February, like 23rd or something like that, where I have texts from her where she's actually saying, movie theaters are closed and people are taking precautions, but still going out, the hysteria and the anxiety is much worse than the virus itself. And then I scroll down and go to text literally a week after that, and just the tone is just completely shifted. Our communication is ramped up like never before. We've all taught all the elder relatives how to use Zoom, and they've actually been figuring it out quite well. So everyone's been getting on these like giant group video chats. And just staying in constant contact because Italy has like an extremely large elderly population, and so many of my relatives are like really old, like super old, like 80s, 90s. So, basically within a week, the tone went from, this is bad, but the anxiety is worse than the virus itself, to like my cousin literally calling in saying, and this is, pre us being mandated to work from home and all of that. So this is when I'm still kind of, New York was still navigating what our next steps were going to look like. I was still kind of carrying on life as usual. That's when that tone shift, and I got that phone call that was literally verbatim. Anyone who tells you that this isn't serious, like, you need to tell them that they could not be more wrong, and do not listen to them. Do not care if people think you're being hysterical. Do not care if people think you're being overreactive. You need to take this seriously. And that very much shook me to my core, because I had literally spoken to her a week prior, and just hearing that in her voice and like the severity of it, and seeing how quickly that shift happened because of, the spike that just got out of control, and seeing in such a short amount of time how that could happen was like really scary. And it really shook me to start taking it incredibly seriously very early on.
So you're looking around going, I'm going to take this seriously, to, you know, regardless of what happens on the state level, federal level, because I'm hearing it firsthand. So you take your own actions, and then, you know, obviously New York follows pretty soon after. Is it fair to say? Or, yeah, I'm looking at the time. Where, I mean, emotionally, you must be, you know, kind of on one side of things, and then you're doing your job. You're working for a New York State senator. So, I mean, I can't imagine the divide. What's happening to you emotionally?
A lot. but that's any given day of my life. So, I had to get that in there. But you know, I'd say a lot though, honestly, but I think the fact that I think it would be more difficult if I was in a job where I was home and I couldn't go to work, or I couldn't work on things, or I was in a more constrained position. I think I'm actually better emotionally than I normally would be, because I'm in a position where I can directly work on these issues. So I feel like I'm doing something, and I feel like, you know, I'm his communications director. So getting mass emails with resources out to the community, responding to, you know, Facebook messages, and making sure that everyone who writes a comment in on our Facebook or whatever is connected with a constituent services specialist the same day. So it's, you know, and that the volume of that has ramped up at least 50%. I mean, it's the amount of calls and emails and messages on, you know, through all our channels has just totally gone through the roof. But that being said, like, that has allowed me to kind of take that, like, very real fear and, like, sadness. Like, my mom is immune compromised. She has an autoimmune disease. So I'm, like, very terrified that something will happen to her if she gets this. And my parents live in Westchester as well. So, like, the messes down there is, you know, has been going on for weeks. So there's definitely, you know, a lot happening. But I think the fact that I'm in a position where I can actually work on it, and I feel like I'm getting information, and I can keep my family updated, and I'm in a position where, you know, my mom can call me after the governor's press conference and ask me questions about what he said, and I can explain them, and that calms her down. Like, that is making me feel better emotionally than I think I would be doing if I wasn't in a position where I could work on these issues like this.
So actually, your job has ended up being therapeutic, and the timing of it being therapeutic,
really think so.
Right?
I really think so.
So who contracted COVID-19 in your family?
So it's a someone I'm really related to through marriage. So it's a cousin's husband's uncle, but also one of my cousin's close friends had gone to Milan for a work trip, like right when all this started. And again, they live in Torino, so northern Italy, you know, a few hours away from Milan. It was bound to happen, right? But he was on a work trip, took all the precautions, wore gloves, wore a mask, traveled during off-peak hours, was, you know, did all the right things. And he still got it. And he's hospitalized, and he's in his early 30s. And, like, he's stable, and he's going to be okay, but, you know, I just feel like people are carrying on like it's just work from home time, but it's not just work from home time. It's isolate and distance yourself time, you know, and that foresight really needs to be, you need to think more in advance. You know, I went to the grocery store the other day and didn't have gloves with me. And I was like, this was a bad decision. So just, you know, thinking like, 5 steps ahead than you normally would.
I was speaking with a professor, a college professor earlier today, who actually studies what she calls positive emotions and how one copes with anxiety and stress and everything, and studied this during 9/11, is now looking at it now. And one of the coping mechanisms is levity. And it reminded me when she said that about, you and I spoke briefly recently, and you had mentioned that you were on, maybe it was WhatsApp, maybe it was Facebook, I don't know, with your family in Italy, and you were singing. And I'm just, you know, I wondered if you could just maybe mention that kind of, you know, as an anecdote about bringing levity to the situation that clearly is incredibly serious, but we still need to live a little bit.
Yes. Things like singing over a Zoom video chat of, you know, 11 or however many relatives total it was, people squeezed into the cameras. You know, that's something we've never done before. And, you know, everyone had, you know, some people in my family play music. So different people had guitars out and, you know, little screens. And we all had, we sang the song Volare, you know, Cantare, oh, Volare, oh, that like famous Italian song. And we just sang that all together through, you know, muffled microphones and like this hilarious echo and delay that was happening. But it was like, we were all crying, laughing for like 10 minutes. And that's something we've never done before and probably wouldn't have done before. You know, why would my, you know, 80-year-old great aunt ever have the need to learn how to use Zoom? But here we are, and she's on there singing now. So, you know, there's definitely that has come from it. And as well, in a, you know, in the position that I have, seeing on the local and, you know, statewide level what's happening, the amount of people that have just reached out to our office just to ask what they can do to help has been carrying me through. I can't even tell you how many people. We sent out a mass, like a blast email, and just had a whole section on how we can help, because we've been getting so many people asking us and reaching out.
I don't know what you felt after, you know, did you feel a sense of relief? Did you, you know, smile for the first time all day?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember my chest just feeling totally released after, when you get one of those like crazy laughs out. And, you know, it was moving in a way too, because we all know the severity of the situation, but are making it a priority to stay in touch in a way that is uplifting and therapeutic to everyone. You know, my cousin's an amazing cook, and she was showing me what she was making the other night and things like that. You know, just maybe something that would have been a photo earlier is now like a whole video chat or a video. And, you know, it's just taken it to kind of that next level of purposeful communication. More like, I'm talking to you because something has made me pause and think about the fact that I'm lucky that I have you in my life a little bit more than usual, a little bit more than let me just text and say, hey. You know, I definitely see myself taking a step back way more than I normally do, and really having those moments where I'm like, I'm lucky I can talk to them, you know, and I'm lucky they're all safe and I'm lucky they're all okay.
There is this report out. This is so interesting. There's, which I don't
know.
UN Women, paying attention to women's needs and leadership will strengthen the COVID-19 response. And, you know, it's about how the women are predominantly on the front lines. And they are the ones handling, you know, a plethora of things, right? Maybe they don't have enough income now, but they have to caregive. And now the kids are home and they have to homeschool. And so, you know, it still is falling to the women. And if they were in jobs that aren't salaried and benefited and they lost them, what about getting back into the workforce? So there's this incredible pressure, yet dependence upon women, right? Globally, women make up 70% of workers in the health and social sector, and they do three times as much unpaid care work at home as men. And that's what they're doing now. So, and that's worldwide. So it's just very interesting. I don't need to work that in, but it just, you know, I don't know if there's that dynamic working in your family in Italy.
Well, there on some level that I will speak to for a minute. So my cousins that I told you about that have that organization that helps bring in these refugees and everything, the two cousins who run it are both women. And so they are, you know, everything is halted, but they're still the ones who are having to, you know, put on the mask and gloves and go check in on all of these houses. They have a bunch of different, you know, apartments where the refugees who they've taken in live temporarily, and they still have to go and take them to the grocery store and make sure that they're getting their stipends and teach them Italian. You know, that's not stopping for them, and those are very important roles that they have in work, but then also at home. We, like I said, we have a lot of older relatives, and, you know, their caregivers who would normally, you know, who are paid workers who normally come in and check in are no longer doing that because they're either working in hospitals or are sick themselves or don't want to, you know, put their own families at risk. And so that's also now falling on the women in my family to be the ones going into the homes of the elderly people in our family, you know, changing them, making sure that they're fed, making sure that no one's fallen. So they've now also taken on, you know, caretaker roles that normally like a literal professional would be handling. So there's a lot. And I've definitely noticed, I mean, my entire life, how much the Italian household depends on women, but I won't get into that.
Jessica Galata lives in New York's Hudson Valley. She is the communications director for State Senator James Skoufis. Elsewhere in the country, a hip-hop and spoken word artist also pays attention to his elders, in particular, his late grandmother, Yue Chang. She arrived in Minnesota in 1996 and could only speak Hmong. She never learned to speak English, yet she and her grandson transcended their language barriers by collaborating as a performance duo. They called their performance collaboration Fresh Traditions, and they'd performed together for 10 years. KFAI producer Emily Bright has the story.
Lost in translation, our language is faded, misplaced in this cage. We engage up the mountains and breathe in the clouds. Hey, what's up, everybody? My name is Two Psych Lee. I'm a spoken word artist, hip-hop MC from St. Paul, Minnesota. The melodic, symbolic words vibrate through us internally.
Getting into hip-hop and spoken word poetry was a way to have a voice in the United States. Growing up, I felt a disconnect from my culture, honestly. Not being able to speak my own Hmong language as well as I should or I could. So as a spoken word poet, I made a connection to what my grandmother does, which is this traditional Hmong poetry called Gutsia. So I went and asked my grandma to perform with me, and she just said, "Tell me where to be, and I will be there to perform with you." I didn't really know what to expect, honestly. I just thought, well, this is an idea. We'll see how it turns out. And I remember thinking through how we would do it, how many stanzas she would say, how many stanzas I would say. And then we would just switch back and forth. So that's kind of how we got together, and we performed for like 10 years. I think Grandma was very humorous, very charismatic, very brash. She didn't read or write. It was either memorized or else she improvised. I remember right after the show, it was at UW-Milwaukee. She had this huge fan base just surrounding her, you know. And then for me, I had, you know, like five people or something. And I just remember thinking Grandma was meant for the stage. She leaned over and asked for my phone number, to write a phone number on this paper. I didn't think anything about it, but a few days later, when we came back to St. Paul, I got a phone call. And then I asked, "How did you get my number?" And she said, "Your grandma told me that you're looking for a wife." And then I was thinking, whoa, grandma's trying to hook me up, you know. And then actually there was like two other phone calls after that, the next few days. It didn't work out, but I knew that's grandma really, she's looking out for me. One time we were booked for a school and we were running behind a bit, so I was really rushing. But grandma would just reach out and she would ask me to slow down. Later, I realized that grandma, when she lived in Laos after the Vietnam War, there were a lot of landmines that were left behind in Laos, and one of them exploded, and a little piece of shrapnel hit my grandma's leg, and that was, it's still in her leg to this day. And so then it made me really think about, to be really considerate about our elder stories and their history. I'm working on an album called Diet Day Comte, which translates to Unified Worldwide. It's my first Hmong language hip-hop album. It's represents my travels, because I've traveled to different Hmong villages, the diaspora of Hmong people. Even though I'm doing this art form that it might be new to a lot of elders, I'm making a connection to our traditional arts. And for people that are from the younger generation, I want them to see that even though we're learning and getting into all these new artistic contemporary styles of expression, that we had our own traditional arts that should definitely be honored and be learned and embraced.
That was hip-hop and spoken word artist Choo Sike Lee. Planned Parenthood is joining other abortion providers in suing Texas over moving to ban abortions during the coronavirus outbreak. The federal lawsuit filed at the end of March in Austin, Texas, is among the most high-profile challenges to a government response to the coronavirus pandemic. The chief executive of Whole Women's Health, an abortion provider with three clinics in Texas, said they canceled 150 appointments in 1 week. Amy Hagstrom Miller said that came after Governor Greg Abbott issued an order that halted all non-essential surgeries to free up doctors to fight COVID-19.
100 years ago, American women won the right to vote. I'm Artie Moskowain. This is Women 100, a series celebrating women who made possible a century of progress. Women like Jeanette Rankin, who was born in 1880 on her parents' Montana ranch and became the first woman elected to Congress in 1917. Rankin was a key organizer for legislation granting voting rights to women with the passage of the 19th Amendment. Known as a progressive on social issues, Rankin was also a pacifist after voting against U.S. involvement in World War I. With World War II on the horizon, she cast the only vote against declaring war on Japan the day after Pearl Harbor. At age 88, Rankin was one of the leaders of the 1968 March on Washington to protest the Vietnam War. Produced by WHYY with Drexel University. For more information, go to whyy.org/women100.
A self-proclaimed city girl is starting a new life at age 61 with chickens. India Hunter brings us the story.
Yeah, they're going to come out of here with the fierceness. Okay. So just stand back.
Okay.
Come on.
In 2016, Cynthia Capers took a leap. She was working in the pharmaceutical industry, and she said, "I'm done. No more. I'm going to raise chickens." Even though the leap was a risk, because she didn't know anything about farming.
Fear drives me. The whole intention of fear, the fact that you're so afraid, you're so scared, you're unsure, that's what drives me to say, no, I will not let it take me over. I will not let it conquer me.
Cynthia is the owner of Henicity Farms right outside Nashville. She owns 100 birds.
Americanas, there's a blue sex link, there's comets, calicos.
She speaks and moves like an expert farmer, like she's been there her whole life.
Speckled Sussex, and they're an endangered breed, and I call them my Meghan Markles. Because for the Duchess, and I got the breed, especially when she became the Duchess of Sussex, I said, oh, I'm getting some Sussex girls then.
Cynthia is 61 years old, and this poultry farm is her third act. Cynthia grew up in the infamous Cabrini-Green projects of Chicago.
Snipers are on the roof. They're having some gang issue. It was just a very intense upbringing. I remember the first time I had a pizza delivered as a young adult. I had never had one because nobody would come. We could not get anything.
She had to get out of the projects. She made her way to college, pre-med, got married, had a kid, but then found herself divorced. Because she had to support her son, she trained to be a nurse, specifically a trauma nurse. One of her jobs was in Washington, D.C., a tough assignment.
These people are in bad way. They're on life and death, and I needed to know that I was giving back.
It set the stage for her own trauma when a patient with a severe gunshot wound came into her unit.
He looked like my son grown up. My son was 4 years old or something, but that looked just like him as a young man. And I freaked out and I started crying. I can't work here. I can't do it. That's my son. And something clicked off.
She could no longer work in the emergency room. So she found a job in clinical research in the pharmaceutical industry. She worked on clinical drug trials.
But I've worked on respiratory, septic, diabetes, blood products, oncologies of every different thing, every organ, everything.
She traveled 90% of the month, more than most pilots. When she wasn't on a plane, she was in meetings. She had a six-figure salary, but she struggled with ethical questions.
Yes, it's paying my bills, but I'm like, if that drug's going to be, one pill is going to be $40, they need a 30-day supply. You know what I mean?
She needed a change, but she was also a single mother. Change came sooner rather than later when she had not one, not two, but three severe asthma attacks while on the road. The last one was the worst.
I couldn't breathe. I knew I couldn't breathe, but I had a little voice that also said, you know you're not going to make it out of here because you're about to hit the floor.
Her doctor said she had to quit. She didn't want to, but inside she knew it was time. She resigned in 2016. She needed a new purpose. When Cynthia was young, all she cared about was chickens.
Everybody wanted to go to the lion house because they hear the roaring and they wanted to go to the monkeys and see all that stuff that was going on with them. I just wanted to be with the baby chicks.
Even when she was on the road, she raised chickens in her home. She decided to take a leap, start her own farm selling eggs and poultry. There was only one problem.
I didn't know anything about none of the stuff that goes on a farm. Nothing. Nothing. The only time I would say anything close to like a camping kind of situation, I was in the Girl Scouts. But that's totally not the farm kind of thing.
How does she learn to farm? She reads books. She asks questions. Signs up for farming academies at local schools. And in her continuing search for knowledge, she's found something else.
Joy. Out of all the things that I've done, this is a different type of joy.
And she's in good company.
Girl, say, did they pick you up like that? What did you tell them? Tell them to leave you alone. Yes, I know. I know.
For the Transom Traveling Workshop in WPLN, I'm India Hunter.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1603.